When David Chang's first restaurant opened in the East Village 5 years ago, he quickly became one of America's hottest chefs. Now he has 4 restaurants, and this past November, Chef Chang was here to discuss his long-anticipated first cookbook, named after his first place, Momofuku. I always enjoyed talking to chefs, and we thought that we would re-air that conversation as many of you prepare special meals for this long holiday weekend. I began our conversation by observing that every chef wants to make it big when he opens a restaurant, and I asked David Chang, what was it like to make it that big with your very first one, something that initially seemed like it would be a rather modest operation?
It was a modest operation, and the goal wasn't even to be big. It was just to open the restaurant and try to stay in business a year.
And what kind of customers did you think would be your typical customers?
I didn't have any idea. You know, we had no expectations, and we were highly underprepared, to say the least.
How long did it take you to adjust? Because restaurants usually there's a little shaking out period, and suddenly you were filled every night.
There certainly was, and we weren't experienced enough. And you know, I'll never forget the day I got a letter from the State Department, being State Tax Department, being like, "You owe such and such back sales tax." And I was like, "What are you talking about, sales tax?" There were so many things about running a business that we had to learn that I think it took away from trying to spend that energy on the food. And eventually we found a balance, and we're trying to maintain that balance still.
Where does the name Momofuku come from? What does it mean?
Originally, when I was in Japan and I was cooking and I was taking some language classes, obviously the first words that I wanted to learn were food and Momo's peach and basic things, and fuku is lucky, and Momo also means limb. So like, you can get Momo, and Momo means like chicken leg and stuff like that. So I just thought that it put those words together. It sort of sounds absolutely ridiculous. It also means lucky peach. And having been a fan of ramen, the creator of instant ramen, and I think it was like in 1954, Momofuku Ando, who founded instant ramen and cup of noodles. That was his name, so I thought that was an indirect nod.
But this is all about Japan. You're Korean-American.
I am.
And in fact, the first sentence in your cookbook is, Koreans are notorious noodle eaters, more than other East Asians?
I think everyone in Asia is a big noodle eater. It's just part of your diet.
Breakfast, along with
noodles.
Rice.
Yeah, rice. My father is... to this day, and I'm sure his personality has its imprints upon our restaurants in some form or fashion, he will call a restaurant and order so the food's ready by the time he gets into the restaurant. And usually it's a hot bowl of soup with noodles in it. So.
And you have to order that in advance? So isn't hot soup something that's...
It's fast already, right?
But he really was fast. And you said that you were honoring the creator of ramen, the instant noodles. Those are the packages you find in most supermarkets.
Right.
But they're great. But
they are great.
They're really not they're not restaurant quality.
No, and they're not restaurant quality. And it's a funny thing. It's something that I don't think Americans will ever appreciate. Even if they spend a week or 2 weeks in Japan, they will never understand the fervor for Japanese ramen. And the closest thing we have to that that passion in terms of food culture is pizza and barbecue. And I always say, if you combine all of that, it will still not even match Japanese love of ramen.
Do you think it's to some degree because of the Japanese obsession with food in general? There's the movie that most captures a sense of foodies in the world is Tampopo.
Yeah, beautiful movie.
And a lot of it has to do with making perfect noodles.
Yes. And that movie is certainly in my top 10 of all time. But when you go to Japan and then you experience this thing and it's a hot bowl of soup, and you're burning your mouth, and you're sweating, and it's just something, you're experiencing flavors and textures that you've never had before, and you realize that, well, I almost spent $20 on a bowl of soup. There's this weird thing that goes through your head where, like, in America, this is only 99 cents, but then it's not the same thing. And people in America have a hard time, I think, coming to terms with the price. Spaghetti and meatballs, you see it all over the place. It's about a $17, $18 dish at most restaurants. There's a lot more work, I think, that goes into homemade ramen than there are in spaghetti and meatballs.
Well, before you opened, there were Japanese noodle shops in New York where pretty much all the customers were Japanese.
Right.
And there were some soba places that made their own soba noodles.
Yes.
So people here were appreciating it. But you say your aha moment came in London.
Well, I was, I think I was like nineteen, and I was in 95 or so, and that was the first year that second year that Alan Yao had opened up this place called Wagamama's. And I was on a student budget, and anytime I went out to eat, it was like $8 or $9, you could have a delicious bowl of food that would fill you up. And that was hard to do on the dollar versus the pound at the time. So,
you also went to the French Culinary Institute.
Yep.
Not hoping to learn how to make noodles.
No. I actually was ready to drop out of college. I was going to enroll in culinary school in Europe, but that didn't happen. And I just wound up following the traditional college route, and then found my way into the kitchen after the French Culinary Institute.
And wound up working in the kinds of places that people who graduate from the French Culinary Institute, Mercer Kitchen and Kraft.
Yes.
And that's before you went to Japan to learn how to make noodles?
Correct.
The David Chang's book, written with the help of Peter Meehan, is called Momofuku, and it is published by Clarkson Potter. For some people, for some reason, when your restaurant opened, didn't people expect Momofuku to be a vegetarian place?
Well, we had a few vegetarian options, and I always say that our restaurant was a progression of mistakes or accidents, and we were trying to play a part in the East Village in terms of food culture and what we were serving people, and serving items that we didn't necessarily want to serve, and wound up being that we had a customer come in one day and almost threatened to sue us and put us out of business because she was served a broth that was obviously pork based. We didn't have any vegetarian soups.
She just assumed that it had been totally vegetarian, but vegetarian restaurants usually tell you that they're not using any meat?
Yeah, but I
think all Chinese food, for example, there's always a chicken stock or some other kind of a meat stock.
Well, we had ginger scallion noodles, and that was the one vegetarian option. And then after that day, I was like, well, to avoid any confusion ever again, we're just going to say that there is nothing vegetarian. Just like you might have something from like a cake factory, and they say like may contain peanuts, and everything may contain some type of animal product. And nothing against vegetarians, but we were at the time a 600 square foot restaurant, so we didn't have the ability to sort of cater to everyone.
There are people who have vegetarian menus on top of the other menus. Charlie Trotter does that in Chicago. Are you ever tempted?
Certainly. I think Mitchell Davis at the James Beard Foundation wanted. He knows how to push my buttons, and he was like, I know how to get David to do a dinner at the Beard House. And he's like, you can't cook vegetables. So I did a vegetarian dinner, just a little bit of dairy. I wish that we could have done a better job, I think, looking back on it. But I love vegetables. But I feel like if we open that door, it's just going to be Pandora's box for us.
Now, you mentioned your father and his love of noodles. Did he think it was a good idea for you to open a restaurant? After all, you had majored in religion at Trinity College.
Mm-hmm. He spent 30 years of his life working very hard for his children. I'm the youngest of four, so that finally, when he had enough money that I could have the best education possible, regardless of how terrible a student I was, so that I would never, ever have to work in a kitchen. And
there you are by choice.
Yes.
You say that one of your most popular dishes, the ginger scallion noodles, is either an homage or an out-and-out ripoff of one of the greatest and least expensive dishes in New York City.
Yeah, I love it to death. I try to go there as much as possible. New York Noodle Town, down off of Canal and Bayard, and it's $4.95, and that price hasn't changed in over 10 years. So, mm-hmm. I think it might have gone up a dollar. But
and you just went in there and you tasted it and you said, "How can I duplicate this?"
It was sort of a revelation, because when you taste the sauce, at least, it was just ginger, scallion, and oil. That's it. Maybe a little salt. And when you put it over something hot, like a bowl of rice or hot noodles, it just is magic. Something magical happens.
We provided the recipe for the ginger scallion noodles and ramen noodles on our show page at WNYC.org. So you make your own ramen noodles?
Yes. Yes and no. Because we now are in a larger location, so we're switching from we have a purveyor that makes it to our specifications, and now we are currently shifting it to all in-house.
You also make your version of what is a very popular thing in Chinatown for usually $1 or $1.50, chashubao,
right.
The pork buns, but you had to come up with your own approach, including your own bread, which is very much like Wonder Bread, isn't it?
It is very much like Wonder Bread. Instead of baking it, you steam it. And people don't really realize this, but bread and steam bread, particularly steam bread, is common throughout northern China and Japan. So I didn't think it was too much of a stretch of the imagination.
So after the first restaurant took off, people expected you to do similar things, and you didn't.
No. At the time, it was Joaquin Baca, myself, and who has his restaurant now in Brooklyn. It's called the Brooklyn Star. And we didn't know what we were doing. We had no game plan. We had no mission statement.
You mean after the first debacle that turned out
yes.
to success, you thought, well, if we did so well not knowing anything, let's do that again?
No, we thought that there's no way we could repeat the same mistakes. And I decided to do this weird Korean-Mexican fusion type burrito bar.
Hadn't you worked at Chipotle at one point?
No, but I was a big fan of Steve Ells, and he had become a mentor and is still a friend, and I just thought that this might work. And I don't know what, I still to this day don't know what made me do it or why nobody around me didn't strangle me to death and say, "This is the worst idea I've ever heard."
And it worked.
It did not work. And out of those ashes of failure became Sambar. And mm-hmm. that sort of became the trademark of Momofuku. We would make just the biggest mistake possible and work our way out of that.
Did that happen with Ko and Milk Bar as well?
No. Ko, was the first time we sort of had the plan and sort of stuck to the plan, and it worked.
Now, you don't allow anyone to skip the line for a reservation at Ko, even critics.
Nope.
Why do you insist that all reservations be made only online?
Well, it's 12 seats, and I've answered phones before, and we don't need a reservationist for 12 seats, mm-hmm. and that's 24 people a day.
Now, why even do 12-seat restaurant? Because it's the only way you can make that kind of food?
Well, again, everything for Momofuku and in terms of how we've grown, it's not because we've wanted to grow. It's because it's been forced upon us. Noodle Bar was literally falling apart. Anytime someone would flush a toilet, our office was underneath. It was this little broom closet, and all our computers would become fried. So we had to move it. We were out of gas, electricity, and then we realized the only way we could continue to lease this space was to have a small restaurant, and that restaurant happened to only hold 12 seats. So that's it.
I should warn listeners with delicate feelings that you do use, well, first of all, you do try to duplicate your voice. The word "like" is in here more than we might expect in a book of the sort. Editors usually take that stuff out. But you also use words that the FCC doesn't allow us to use on the air. Is that because you want the readers to get a sense of what it's like to work in a kitchen?
And work in the kitchen, and Peter Meehan, I think, did a wonderful job of capturing my voice and how I interact and with the people around me. And it's just like I would say in any other business, maybe even the radio business, when things are off the air, I'm sure it's not always clean cut. So we just decided to...
I'm the most clean-cut person you'll ever meet. There are some ingredients here that might be challenging to locate. Are they all available in Chinatown?
They are all available.
Now New York has about three or four major Chinatowns.
Yes, Flushing, Brooklyn, and...
And what about the Korean places? Do you do much Korean food?
We do, but it's just tiny, tiny influences, flavors.
Like transglutaminase.
That is certainly not Korean. That is something that was introduced to me by Wiley Dufresne, and it's a naturally occurring enzyme, but we call it Miklu. Mm-hmm. I wish there was a better name for it, Activa, actually, but that you can actually mail order. There's nothing we have that you can't go to an Asian supermarket or get online.
And can you substitute things?
Certainly. We substitute things all the time.
You also include a recipe for a dish that you took off the menu for roasted sweet summer corn because it was so popular?
It came back on this summer, but we added a few things on it. It was miso. It was corn with miso butter and sautéed with little onions. And as a side dish, that's all we served, every order. And it's certainly flattering, and it was great, but it was sort of demoralizing to the crew.
It gets boring after a while.
Yes.
And that is a problem because you take something off the menu and then people say, but that was my favorite thing. How could you do that?
Well, we have the perfect answer. It's like it's not corn season anymore. So we were looking forward towards the cold weather of October to take that dish off.
The book Momofuku, which is published by Clarkson Potter, and written with the help of Peter Meehan. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.